Since 1970, poet Dave Smith has written well over 24 books, including fiction and essays. His teaching career has taken him from Utah to Baltimore to Mississippi, where he lived across the street from Faulkner's old home place in Oxford. Always connected to the natural world, he writes eloquently about his surroundings.
Early on, and often throughout the course of my writing life, people have referred to me as a poet of place. And I accept that, not without a certain amount of pride.
Listen to Dave Smith talk about his life in poetry and his more recent books, Hawkshog Wires and Hunting Men, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and while Dave Smith was at Rockhurst University's Fall 2014 Midwest Poet Series, we talked about why he so often returns in his work to the Virginia Tidewater of his youth.
Naturally, one wants to tell the stories of one's place and one's life events in a place. It's the material you have. My first book of poems, which was called The Fisherman's Whore, and the referent there is to boats, it does locate its interests, its subjects, its attempts at discoveries in the area where I grew up. But I also would add to that that in some sense for me that book was an artificial book. Some of the subjects are drastically and foolishly romanticized. The fishermen are all hardy heroes. There are no weak, difficult people in that. The women are all long-suffering mates. Maybe I wasn't capable of seeing any more than that. But in any case, the book was reviewed in a journal, and the fellow in the review said, well, we won't know whether this poet's of any interest to us until he goes inland. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to say. And as it happened, I finished my graduate work and moved to Utah to teach in my first job. So the next book was a book called Goshawk Antelope, which was set very largely in Salt Lake and the areas around the Western Desert. And I thought, well, that'll shut him up.
You know? You can't go much more inland
No, you can't. But it's also true that I, in every book, have gone back to my home experiences. The Tidewater, which is not the same as it was by any means when I grew up and left at 18, nevertheless has something compelling to me, to my imagination. And I'm sure that it has to do with the ocean and the mythical presences one feels in that. In the same way my parents felt a presence in the mountains along the Appalachian Corridor. They grew up in the mountains of Maryland, and I was there enough that I felt that very strongly. And when I went away to college, first thing I saw were those mountains, and I felt welcomed, but welcomed in a different way. Landscape is important to me. I'm not entirely sure what it means to be a poet of place, other than that places seem to me to have what James Wright once referred to as a genius of the place, a spirit that somehow energizes and invigorates the imagination. All the years I've been working at this, it seems unquenchable. You can't get to the end of it.
Well, one of your newer poems in the collection, The Wick of Memory, takes us back there. It's called Night Pleasures. Do you want to read that?
Yes, happy
to. To give people a sense of the country?
Night Pleasures is exactly what I was referring to in talking about the feeling I have that my imagination is located centrally, somehow, in this place. Night Pleasures. Where I come from, land lies flat as paper. Pine, spruce, holly, like dark words left from a woods. Creeks coil, curve, enigmatic as women. To know the depths, you must dream. In the mountains for college, I walked up and could see barns, cows, house smoke, but no boats. Hillsides of apples, still, perfect. Here, my little boat takes the night bay. One far neon light tosses. A city, people walk alone, its rhythmic landscape cut from marshes and cries. On black water, it is all mine. First beginnings, endings, love's beauties. So when I move, it moves under me and knows me.
Night Pleasures, included in the collection The Wick of Memory, New and Selected Poems, 1970 to 2000, by Dave Smith, who's here with me today for New Letters on the Air.
There's a little story behind it. When I graduated from college, it was 1965, the draft was on, I was drafted, and I didn't want to go, like many people.
And we're talking Vietnam.
Vietnam. Right. I started calling local school districts to see if I could find a teaching position, because you could be exempted from the draft for that purpose. And in a small town called Pocosin, Virginia, which is next to Yorktown, Virginia, I found that after I'd been told over and over again no one needed English teachers, they were an ample bunch, the principal said to me, "Can you teach French?" I said, "Yes, yes, I can." And he said, "Well, can you also coach?" I said, "Oh, can I coach?" So I was hired as an assistant football coach and a French coach. My grandparents had lived maybe 15, 20 miles from Pocosin, but I'd never been there, had no idea it existed. It was a fishing village on the Chesapeake Bay. And in the first year I was there, I met my wife of now 48 years. I met my dearest friends. I met people whose lives embraced mine and allowed me to discover I had an imagination, and they and their culture became the subjects of that. So this is a place where, as I used to say to people, the fishermen are farmers on water. They live by the cycles of time and season and hard work, and it's easy to rhapsodize about them. They're also regular people. But to me, it was a land of giants and a place where I was welcome. And in this poem, I tell the story about going off to college in Charlottesville, seeing the mountains really for the first time, and then coming home to Pocosin some years later, recognizing this really was home. And to tell you the honest truth, I could go back there tomorrow, I think, and be just as happy were it not for my kids and grandkids being somewhere where I need and want to be.
Well, it's interesting to me that in your collection, Hawks on Wires, you dedicated this book to your own grandsons, but your grandfather in particular. You know, there are a lot of poems where you're looking back at his life.
Both of my grandfathers, and indeed my uncle and much of other members of my family, were all connected to the Baltimore, Ohio Railroad, which in the 20s and 30s, when my mother and father were growing up there, Cumberland was a great center of trade with the Potomac River there and the railroad that came in. And so my people, as Jim Dickey would say, were closely tied to the railroad. But the railroad lost much of its market and its vigor. And before World War II, my grandfather Cornwell, who was a budding naval engineer, but who had been trained in the B&O railroad engineer. He wasn't a college man. He took a job with the Navy Department in Norfolk, Virginia, and so he left the mountains. He was the first of them to leave. The others never left, so I still have family there.
Cousins and such.
And I don't know them well. I know them, but I don't know them well because I grew up 300 miles away. The only time we went back, basically, was for funerals. And I've written about that. One of my books is called Cumberland Station.
You also have that book from 1985 called The Roundhouse Voices.
Roundhouse Voices. That was about my Uncle Lloyd, who was, in fact, the foreman of the B&O Roundhouse in Cumberland, Maryland. And I've written about my grandfather so often because he was the male model in my life. My father died in an automobile accident when I was 17.
On Mother's Day. Mother was really hurt in the accident,
yes,
I read in one of your essays.
But that brings me to talk about these poems, and particularly the title poem. My mother was living in Tidewater, Virginia, while we were in Maryland. And we knew we wanted to be there because I was the only one who could provide her the kind of help that an aging parent needs. And she got sicker and sicker. And so I found myself in 2006 and 7 and 8, driving the 225 miles down to Newport News to see her and take care of her more and more frequently. And as I would drive to through the beautiful Virginia countryside that runs along the Rappahannock River, I would see hawks along the wires, just looking. And they always seemed to be looking as if they knew something special. Birds are really fascinating. Often, if they're predator birds particularly, they're not communal. They don't like to be around each other. They like to be solitary. And trip after trip, I made down to see my mother, getting more and more sure that her time was coming, watching these birds and making up little stories about how they seemed to know what was going on. So I think this is a book of poems. While it's about a number of members of my family, it's really about my mother more than any of my other books. People have always said to me, why do you write so much about your father? Well, for once, I've written a good bit about my mother.
And, how about we hear that poem, Hawks on Wires?
Along the two-lane asphalt that winds to the house where my mother is dying, they dot the sky. Always alone, even the littlest, heads untucked, eyes calibrating like laser beams, bodies like bolts. Nothing their size can rise free from the earth, but must stay put in ditch shadow, in tree groin. A swiveling gather of the head on its axle is able to hold sunshaft or cloud step and matches up how far and how quick. Its vectoring geometry, a gift of the nest, a gift of the air, without scruple. The wires are like skin twists. They are quivering like cello strings, genius figures. The notes I have in mind faint before the birth of Jesus, before any splash sibilant on the first beach, or the brilliant spatter of blood drip over pine needles. The rustle of what is happening, so the whole field knows, presses on me as if the wires have been programmed. Players looking up, ready, even the roadkill deer. Legs rigid, death stiffened, cornea glazed and aqueous humor already iced, gag of the doe goes with me. Mozart on my radio. Will prayers be heard? My wheels strike nothing. A gust on tiny ears shudders for small hawks waiting until God sings, I want you to send me mysteries in plain weathered shapes. So, whimpering, they start to fling themselves forth. Below, muzzles cold, tongues needing light, scurry like the unloosened spray of stars when wind turns. A story opens. A mother's milky first voice begins.
That's Dave Smith. He read the title poem from his collection, Hawks on Wires, that was published in 2011. And you're listening to New Letters on the Air.
That's a little difficult, I think, if you don't see it on the page. You probably notice I borrowed a little from Mr. Whitman there, the gag of the doe.
When I read that, to me it felt so elegiac.
I wanted to get back to what I most remembered of my mother. And of all the things, it was being read a story that somehow would form, as it does for all of us, our sense of what's happening.
Why do you think you wrote so much about your dad? Do you think it's because you were trying to discover him since he died when you were so young, and yet your mother was there but not there because she remarried and there was a parting of the ways somewhat?
Right. Throughout most of my poetry, I didn't write about my mother. Now, I don't know why. It wasn't a conscious decision. It was a process of rediscovery. The poet William Hayen, we used to correspond a good bit in real letters, and it was so much fun to get a letter. And I remember in one of them, he said, isn't it interesting how all of us seem to write about our fathers? But he was the mystery to me, more so than she was. And as she sickened and came nearer to her death, it's funny the things you want. I wanted desperately from her the stories of our family, because I came quickly to see there wasn't anybody else who was going to have them. And her side of the family, which had gone to Virginia, had dissevered itself from the Cumberland side, and I didn't know the interlocking stories. So that was part of it, trying to keep a grip on a history that indicated who I was or might be.
You write wonderfully in one of your essays about poetry allowing you to recover things that you may not have known on some knowable level until you come across it.
Well,
again.
I think that's absolutely true. And I'm sure there's a psychologist, if not a psychotherapist, who has a term for what happens. My father, I saw him walk out of the house and I never saw him again. And I was so traumatized. I was in the spring of my junior year in high school, and I almost don't remember my senior year. I mean, literally, there are long durations where things happen, but I have no memory of them happening. But what I discovered over the years was that, oddly enough, with poetry, I could dig my way back to re-experiencing moments by combining a process of inventing and remembering. I was able to create a reenactment. Mr. Robert Penn Warren, the poet I most admire, argues that that's what a poem does. It enables you to return to the past and to reenact experiences which can become measurements of your own identity and responsibility. So that in that sense, they are not only recoveries, they're educations and explorations for the moments that you haven't yet lived. I can see my mother's last healthy months, and I would go and sit with her, and my wife would be with me, and my mother would say, "Well, you remember your father? He would have said so-and-so," and I would look at her, and I would say, "No, ma'am, I don't remember." And I was telling the truth, but she could barely abide the fact that I couldn't remember what to her was crystal clear. So recovery is a process that's central to my sense of what a poem tries to do.
I think that's also what allows you to revisit some of the same scenes, but to look at them from a different vantage point. Because if you read your books covering the years, sometimes we'll return to a certain scene, but it's told in a little bit different way where it shines a different light. You see into the nooks and corners of a different direction.
And some of this you learn to do as a practicing writer. You practice narrative strategies. Some of it is so instinctive, you can't even think about it. It just comes to you.
You have this wonderful book. It's called Hunting Men, Reflections on a Life in American Poetry. And it gives some insight not only into your life as a poet, but into the lives of different poets. I mean, I love that you really spend some time with essays on various poets who have affected you, from people who have been friends of yours, like Stephen Dunn, William Matthews, Richard Hugo. But you also go back in time as well, talking about Edgar Allan Poe and John Crow Ransom. But it touches on something that comes up again and again for you, even though the more you read of your work, the more you realize you don't do that much hunting anymore. But what is it about hunting? You actually address this in another essay that was published in New Letters magazine.
Sometimes the things that we love the most are the least accessible to explanations. I think another one of the things my poems have tried to do for me is to establish continuities between whoever I may be and those, particularly men, but also women, in my life who were formative and loving. Hunting was maybe the first thing I did with my adult male line that somehow put me in touch with cycles of realities. It was seasonal. It was a sense that there was life out there and mysteries that you could connect with, even if it involved, and one doesn't want to blink this away, killing. Although I did far more hunting than I ever did killing, and trust me on that. But my grandfather took me, beginning when I was 6 years old, to hunt squirrel. and it was ritualized. We would go before dark in his old Hudson car, huge automobile, and we would park at the edge of the woods. He knew where he was going. We would go in by flashlight. He would take me to a log. We would sit on the log, and then we would scuff away with our heels a space in the leaves so we wouldn't make noise when we stood up. And at daybreak, the squirrels would come looking for nuts. And then we would shoot. Well, I didn't shoot. He would shoot, and I would watch. And I was initiated into this process through very intimate and loving conversations where we sat on the log, and he told me about his ancestors and himself. Then after a time in my life, I didn't hunt squirrels anymore, because one of my grandfather's rules was you had to eat the squirrels you shot, and it fell to me to clean them. So that was that was a task I wasn't keen about. But I cleaned them, I ate them, and then a time came when I wanted no more of that, and I didn't hunt for a while. My father didn't hunt, so we didn't have that connection. But then when my father died, I was sort of adopted by a family in my home area who hunted quail. Squirrel hunting was very quiet, very sedentary. You could talk quietly among yourself, but that was it. But with these quail hunters, you had dogs. The dog's job was to go find the bird. You walked along with two, three, I've hunted with as many as eight, and they laughed. It was like a jolly posse until you got to the bird, and then with any kind of luck, you shot the bird, the dog fetched it, you put it in your pocket, and you went on to the next one. But in fact, even in the 60s, when this was happening, the bird population was declining, and we didn't kill all that many. What we did was we killed a lot of time getting to know each other and the histories of our families and the people around there and the culture. It was an education in human behavior, and that was incredibly valuable to me and still is valuable to me. And I, in similar ways, initiated my son into it, who is now an avid woodcock hunter on his own. And his six-year-old son will pretty soon be going with him into the field.
And you still have a gun that you're going to give him, right?
Oh, I certainly do. Still have guns.
That your grandfather gave to you.
My grandfather's gun and my own gun. And I understand and am sympathetic to the darker sides of this. Quail hunters like to stand together and talk about all the reasons the quail have disappeared all over the country. And it's always some, it's pesticides, it's big farms, it's the Russians. I mean, really, I've heard that. But you know, they never say, it's us, we who killed off the quail. And surely we are as guilty of decimating that natural resource as anyone. But that's not to say that there wasn't and isn't value in that cultural practice.
Well, you said it was seasonal, but it's also cyclical. You know,
yes,
there's something kind of reaffirming about that, the fact that something comes back again and again. I'm Angela Elam, and I'm with Dave Smith, who has written a couple of dozen books, primarily poetry, but you've also written lots of essays, including your essay that you wrote for New Letters 80th Anniversary magazine about dogs. But I think I'm going to have you read a poem in Hawks on Wires, Early Bird Dog Training.
Yeah, I don't venture into sonnets very often, but this is a sonnet.
I read in one of your essays that sometimes the form chooses the poem rather than you starting out to write something as a sonnet. But
I think that's quite true. I don't know why it happens. I think we tend to teach as if poets make form choices out of strategies of thinking that are logical and syllogistic and cold in their decision-making. I find it not at all true. I fumble forward often enough until the poem says, okay, here I am, you know, take off, and I do what I can. And I think this must be very common among poets. But I also think in this case, I wanted this poem to be early on in the book, and I wanted to suggest something about a form awareness or ritual undertaking. Bird dog training is pretty habit-oriented. It's repetition. I've had three Brittany Spaniels, and they all got excellent training. And even though we don't hunt very much, when they go to the field, they're remarkable.
They know what their
they
job is.
They know what they're about. Yeah. Now, of course, I don't think training is entirely it. Genes tell the dog what to do and why to do it. Training hones that practice. Well, in this case, I'm talking about training a dog as if I were the trainer, but also I'm trying to vaguely suggest writing a poem is a bit like that same kind of act of discovery. There are a lot of little jokes in it to me. My second bird dog was named Finn, F-I-N-N. So when he died, we got a new one, and we tried out various names, and none would seem to stick. So we called him Finn number two. And even that wouldn't stick. So we lapsed into calling him Dog. And that's what I call him. And that's what he answers to is Dog. So Dog rhymed with log, so that made a nice thing. But it's also, there's a mystery to this. Anybody who's had a bird dog will understand this. The dog points by instinct, and he stops and points. The reason is pretty clear. He's afraid if he moves, he will frighten it away, and he wants to grab it. So he's being cautious. And you train him to transfer that caution to your voice, your commands. But once he's in the field, why doesn't he point sparrows? He'll see birds that move, and they could be the size of a quail, but he won't point them. And then the other side of that, let's suppose you shoot a quail, you knock it out of the air. He'll go pick it up and bring it back to you. That's part of the ritual. But if there's a dead bird, somebody else has shot, he won't pick it up. He won't even look at it. Now, these are mysteries that I have no explanation for. So part of what I hope to get at through pointing out the dog's rituals is how inexplicable in some ways training oneself to be a poet is. So the poem is called Early Bird Dog Training. July day, walking Finn number two, headstrong pup who makes my arm twitch with fatigue. The pronged stick I tap for stress, hot incentive to him. 10 months now, he hears every bird the same. His heart boils, and soon his tongue lolls sidewise. I don't know his limits, so leash his desires worst. Though he bucks and huffs and whines, heel, heel, I bark, acolytes metering a suburb's field, until he's caught by a goldfinch, is that it? Wild canary, butterfly yellow that flits, scolds, seaming the beaten path with beauty's signal. How bold, notes from a hidden branch that trembles. Yet I can't find the nesting tree, nor can dog, who unmoved by form, points not song, but log.
Early Bird Dog Training from Hawks on Wires by Dave Smith, published by Louisiana State University Press, along with his essay book, Hunting Men, Reflections on a Life in American Poetry. Part of Rockhurst University's Fall 2014 Midwest Poet Series, Dave Smith is now retired and living in Baton Rouge near his grandchildren, where he takes them hunting. For links to books and to hear other programs with him, visit newletters.org. This show was produced with Coy Duggar, Elizabeth Albano, and Jamie Walsh. From New Letters Magazine at UMKC, I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.